Jay Barrett is behind the board this morning.
Greetings.
Good morning, Jay. Good to see you.
It's nice to be awake.
And also joining us, two intrepid reporters from the Peninsula Clarion, Elizabeth Earle and Kat Sorensen. Thanks so much for being here, ladies.
Thank you.
Oh, it helps if I turn your microphones on.
Oh.
Yeah. Did I say I was awake?
Live radio, working without a net here.
Here's my third pot of coffee.
Well, so I want to go ahead, and get started. I was here not too late last night, but watching the returns come in. Liz, I know you were at the office as well last night. And what's on your mind as you were kind of typing up stories last night and talking to folks and thinking about this mayoral election?
Well, first on my mind yesterday was just sort of the obvious conclusion that not very many people came out to vote yesterday.
Yes.
If you visited any of the polling sites, I went to about 10 or 11 of them. I saw maybe 3 people at any time in there. It was pretty quiet most of the day. And number one in the morning is just if you were out yesterday morning, you know that there was some ice and there was some snow. And that makes for a really fun time trying to convince folks that get nervous without snow tires on the first snow of the season to come out and vote. So that was a little bit disheartening to watch, especially after the very significant good turnout that we saw on October 3rd. The election canvas boards told me that they thought that there was probably some lack of interest or perhaps lack of awareness. But sitting there watching the results come in last night, looks like things are very close. I think the actual differential is about 226 votes. And there's a pretty clear division between where the votes got cast. Homer very heavily went for Linda Hutchings.
Yeah, very much so. Like 2-1 or more.
Something like that. Like 70% in Homer 1 and pretty close to that in Diamond Ridge as well. But then the outlying areas, just like in the last election, went for Charlie Pierce. Pretty hot and heavy.
Yeah, it's interesting to look on the map. And I, going back to the regular election at the beginning of the month, you know, Homer was a Linda Farnsworth Hutchings area. You look at this one, Seward, I think, went to Linda. And if you kind of follow the Seward Highway around the perimeter of the peninsula, all those areas seem to go for Linda Farnsworth Hutchings. Interesting that in a couple of pockets, there are a lot of votes to be had. But, you know, if you're picking up places like Hope or Moose Pass, that doesn't contribute a whole lot. But again, a very close race with just 226 votes and well over 1,000 absentee ballots yet to count. So what are your thoughts? Is a strong absentee turnout good for one candidate or the other? Is there any... You have any thoughts on that?
It's hard to say because in our experience, just at the paper counting things over the years, absentee ballots tend to track fairly well with the general tenor of the borough election. So it's hard to say whether one way skews one way or the other. When I talked to Linda last night, she said she felt fairly confident that she picked up a lot of absentee ballots in the last round and that she was hopefully holding out some optimism. Although just calculating the odds, obviously she has to pick up a pretty significant 226 votes there in this borough. That is pretty significant. But to counterbalance that, she not only has to pick that up, she has to pick up more votes than Charlie does in the absentee. And so it's a pretty good gap to pick up. What you said about the outlier or the tracing the Seward Highway around and the Sterling Highway, that tracks a lot with what I heard from the two candidates when I spoke to them. Just from visiting the outlying areas, they spent a lot of time in Homer and Seward this particular election. And one of the challenges in picking up votes in the Kenai Peninsula is that our communities are so far flung. That you spend a lot of time tracking around from Hope to if you can get a chance to get to Nanwalek and Port Graham. Those places are equally important citizens of the borough, but it's a challenge to get out there. And there's maybe 25 active voters. I think Tyonek had 8 ballots cast total.
8 ballots cast in Tyonek. It's always kind of interesting to look at the returns from across Kachemak Bay or across the inlet, because those are even for the Kenai Peninsula, those can be surprisingly small numbers. But in a race like this, hey, you never know.
It's important not to treat them like the Puerto Rico of the Kenai Peninsula.
And hats off to those folks for voting, because I'm sure it doesn't feel like those votes count, but they do. And every vote counts, especially when turnout is about 13.5%.
You know, I look back at the regular election and the absentees there, and Farnsworth Hutchings did get 41 more votes in the absentee ballots than Charlie Pierce.
Hmm.
So,
what were the number of absentee ballots?
There were, Absentee ballots in the regular election were 2,698. She got 35%, and Hutchings got 33%.
And what about Dale?
He got whatever was left.
Yeah.
don't make me do math.
Yeah. I ran into those.
Spot, I'm sorry.
I ran into those troubles last night. I was mistakenly tried to do math. That's not a reporter thing. Does anybody have any thoughts on how many Dale Bagley votes even there were to pick up, and where those may have gone?
Ooh, that was the Rubik's Cube.
That was, isn't it? Yeah, that's the million-dollar question, kind of.
We had a good, hearty debate on where we thought Soldotna was going to go, because in the first round, Dale Bagley took Soldotna with the majority, and then Charlie Pierce hit second. But in this round, Linda Hutchings picked up a lot of those votes, and she led in Soldotna, which meant that probably a lot of Dale Bagley's votes went straight to Linda in the city of Soldotna. But I think probably many of Dale Bagley's votes in the outlying areas ended up going to Charlie Pierce, just judging by the results last night.
Or they just disappeared because about 30% less people showed up.
And yeah, there's also that. And you can't discount, we saw historic absentee voter turnout in the regular election earlier this month.
Right.
But how much of that was due to maybe one ballot proposition in particular, that drove that to be 30% higher voter turnout absentee than anybody can really remember seeing?
And that was something we talked about last night, too, that there could be a sort of drop off, first of all, in those 3 weeks where it's like, that's a long time to wait. But there's also just not as much interesting stuff dragging people out. We didn't have Prop 1. We didn't have Prop 3, which was tax. Taxes are exciting to vote on. But we also had that ugliness of the back and forth between the two candidates over the last couple of weeks, which possibly disenchanted some people and said, I'm done with politics. Take me out.
You think so?
I think it might have had something to do with it, given what I've seen in the national elections as well, just from talking to people my age and from talking to other voters around the borough.
I saw, and I'm curious what you all think of this, I saw a lot of parallels in this mayoral election compared to the national presidential election in 2016, both in terms of a female and a male running for the same office, and both talking about their base in a supposedly non-partisan election, and it just seemed to have a lot of carryover in terms of the energy and sort of the messaging and the angles at which people were coming at this thing.
Mm.
See, I thought that.
And that surprised me as well, that especially on the first round. I'm sure that you remember sitting in the studio on the evening of November the 8th, 2016, and the fact that almost every reporter in the country was, what did we do wrong? Because none of us called that election. I was inclined to think more along these lines on the October 3rd election, but it did surprise me how heavily the borough came out for Charlie Pierce. I thought that the name recognition that Dale Bagley had would have given him much more carriage, because he's been in the borough government for the last 15-odd years, 20 years on and off, and then Linda Hutchings having been around as a car salesman and as a member of the community in the various different clubs she's been a part of, I would have thought that that would have also carried her through reputation. But I think that you're right, just in terms of the dynamic between candidates. We talk about like how aggressive politics have gotten in the last 10 years or so. We also forget that there's a historical precedent for that. Politics were much nastier in the United States in the 19th century and the early 20th century. And so possibly we're getting back to that. But I can't say, because I'm not 200 years old. I wasn't there for that part.
That's something, if you have some thoughts on this, we would love to hear your thoughts on this as well. 283-8414 is the number again, 283-8414, kind of talking about the tone and the tenor of this campaign. Jay, I'm looking to you for some of your background experience.
I was here 200 years ago. As evidenced by my Santa Claus beard.
Yes. Well, and I mean, short of an Aaron Burr, Alexander Hamilton duel out on the North Beach. I mean, have you seen it come to this? I mean, we had trading barbs back and forth for, as Liz said, the last few weeks, and people calling each other bullies and this and that.
I actually found it a little refreshing, because I often find candidates tiptoeing around each other and never really saying what they think, and it's just... they leave it to friends to conduct whisper campaigns about the others. And maybe there was some of that, but I found it kind of refreshing when we had the two candidates here the other week. Was it just last week? It was 2 weeks ago.
2 weeks ago, yes.
Yeah. To have them, kind of go head to head. And really kind of say what they thought about mm-hmm. each other. Linda didn't come out and call Charlie a bully, but she certainly implied it, and she certainly called Charlie to task for what she considered rumors that he was planting about her, about bankruptcy and such.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's all the, you know, that's such interesting ground to sort of try and tread, you know, when you've got a small community and a lot of folks sort of out there swinging a bat for you. You can't be responsible for everything everyone says, but at the same time, you know, it's two sides. Everybody kind of knows who's speaking on behalf of whom. What were your thoughts? I know, Liz, you reported on the cease and desist letter. What were your thoughts when you saw that one come down the pike?
And part of that was I had known about the domestic violence charge for months, mm-hmm. And it hadn't been an issue because, and you brought it up, that in small towns there is a lot of dynamic to interpersonal politics that there isn't in large cities. I reported on politics for a little while when I lived in Chicago, and the dynamic of nastiness between candidates feels almost more impersonal, like you expect to be personally attacked, but because you don't see those people in the grocery store, it's not as big of a deal. Whereas around here, it seems like there's almost sort of an etiquette of don't go after the person and their children and their dogs because you see them in the grocery store. But the dynamic of that became that charge was weaponized by people that weren't on Charlie's campaign or, as I understand, not on Linda's.
Mm-hmm.
And so because it became a political flashpoint for people to pass around these rumors, especially with the proliferation of social media, I felt like it was my duty to respond to that and to report on it and get the facts out there. And it did set off a lot of emotions, in part because of the interpersonal dynamics, because people have known these two candidates for very long periods of time personally.
Yeah.
And that raised some interesting questions also about the importance of background records, whether we give people a chance to start clean when they come into public office, or whether we make sure we dredge up every bit of their history, especially in a small town like this one, where a lot of it's already known. When you look through people's pasts, you see a lot of recurring names too. And it raised a lot of interesting conversations, especially in our office, about how that should be handled.
Yeah, we had some conversations like that too, because again, two folks who have lived in the community for a long, long time, and you hear anecdotes, mm-hmm. and you know, how do you make that? I never felt like it was necessarily the job of the reporter to sort of qualify a person's character in that way. If you have your own experience with this person in this community, you bring that to the voting booth with you. That's not necessarily the job of the reporter to try and define who these people are in terms of their character, beyond things that make, you know, legal headlines. You know, there's a domestic violence charge, we're going to cover that, of course, but you know, beyond those sorts of things, it's tough to kind of quantify that a little bit for people.
Yeah, and then that's when it starts stepping into the territory of being gossip column.
Right.
You know, I can't go and report on something that I heard somebody say at the grocery
right.
store.
Exactly.
All the way back to the grocery store, too.
Did you guys get any of that? You know what I heard guys
yeah.
should be reporting on.
Mm-hmm.
Did you?
Oh, all the time.
Yeah.
You get phone calls where you don't want to insult the person who thinks they're coming to you with something important, mm-hmm. But you also don't want to turn it into something that makes you a gossip columnist.
Yeah.
You try to be as responsible as possible while not ignoring things that could cause issues in the future, because I agree with you that it's not really the reporter's job to validate people. It's our job to validate records and hold people responsible for what they do rather than perhaps who they are. But there's also kind of an interesting question to that. I don't think I should be morally castigating people for their choices, but I am held responsible to clarify the conversation in the community. And I think that's my job, and I'm willing to take the heat for that. But I also don't want to start rumors inappropriately, too.
Taking heat this morning on the Key Night Conversation. If you'd like to jump in on the conversation, 283-8414. Again, 283-8414. We're talking about the Kenai Peninsula Borough mayoral election. That's been a real hot topic the past few weeks. We'd love to hear your opinions on that. If you've got any, give us a call or drop us a line on Facebook if you would care to get in touch that way.
Yeah. You know, I was wondering, how do you think the two candidates handled your story on the cease and desist order, right?
Well, it was actually very civil. I made the courtesy calls to both of them because I had the documents to work with, and I had gotten the call that morning actually through a sequence of other phone calls that the cease and desist letter was floating around out there. Linda, of course, I had a very civil conversation with about the letter that morning. And when I called Charlie, he was also very civil about it. And after you publish a story like that, I'm sure that you know through reporters quaking that you're always a little afraid of what the Facebook reactions are going to be the next day. I actually disappeared to Denali for a couple days right after that story ran. But then I came back and I hadn't seen either of them, but I ran into both of them yesterday morning and they were both incredibly civil about it. Which I thought spoke well of both of them. As I'm sure some people are aware, and probably was mentioned, I did get a phone call from Charlie's lawyer the morning before I published that story, but nothing came of it.
Yeah, and you know, one thing that I would say about covering this election is that at no point was it ever difficult to get a hold of either candidate. They were always happy to talk. They were, for the most part, in my experience, tended to be pretty forthcoming in their answers, especially, again, as we point out, the second leg of this election was just really, really interesting, and both candidates really opened up a lot, and I think they were kind of took the gloves off a little bit.
Mm. It raised a lot of chances for me to talk with them more personally about their personal beliefs about government.
Absolutely, yeah.
And that, in a race where you have three people who bill themselves as long-term Republicans, I think that that leads to a much more interesting conversation where you can get into the more enthralling parts of what do you think about people's relationships to government, particularly in our budget outcomes right now, and then also the somewhat vague future of the Kenai Peninsula and how our government is going to function here, about how much of a role taxes are going to play and how much of a how much of an obligation we have to provide certain services.
Do you think that the fact that they, the three candidates, billed themselves as Republicans, and in fact, I think we had, when you had Dale on the show, he said, well, I don't think there's much difference between the three of us.
Yeah.
But I think that especially after the regular election, do you think the fact that, well, not the fact that they all call themselves Republicans, but do you think that the fact that there wasn't a Democrat or, you know, somebody, you know, more obviously liberal, like a Mike Navarre or a John Williams, wasn't running, sort of hurt Farnsworth Hutchings, because you know, maybe she might have been seen as not as conservative?
I think part of that leads to two very interesting little points. One was that Linda earned a lot of support from some of the local Democrat groups, in part because I think that they wanted to cast their vote behind someone who they, much the same as the 2016 election, mm-hmm. they wanted to throw their vote behind someone who wasn't the more conservative candidate, but also she was a female, mm-hmm. and she holds the chance of being the first borough mayor who's a female, and that's considered a progressive topic, and so she had that in her court. But she also, when I had a couple of conversations with her, she told me that she was a fiscal conservative and a social liberal on a lot of issues, which I think lent itself to more of the democratic process, just in terms of what she gained in voter support. But the other part of that was that I came from another background, from a sort of monopolitical situation in Chicago, where everybody is a Democrat. I think there's maybe one Republican
alderman. Just for sport?
But it leads to sort of a blood sport in terms of cannibalizing the party.
Sure.
Because then you get into the more interesting conversations of, you don't have a list of political places where you can start, and you get to know the candidates much more intimately when you have to ask them what they actually think, rather than asking them what party they stand for.
And also, maybe important to note that of the three candidates, Linda had the most blue on her signs.
I didn't not notice that.
See, exactly. Yeah, it creeps up on you. It creeps up on you.
Kat, you're nodding your head when I ask that question. Do you have thoughts on?
I immediately think back to the George Washington farewell address, where there shouldn't be parties in general. And I think that the overall Republican, everybody being on the Republican ticket, was more how an election should be. You should be able to go down and really get into their political beliefs and their beliefs on social issues and things like that, instead of just saying, oh, she's a Democrat, I'll vote for her, or, oh, she's a Republican, I'll vote for her. I think it's just more of a it's more progressive in a way that's how elections should be run, in my opinion, not as a reporter. So I was nodding, yes, like, I think that's how this should be happening. I don't believe in the two-party system is as great as it can be.
Certainly. Maybe sometime we could come in and do like 3 or 4 hours on that.
Yeah.
But,
pull a Dan Carlin. I could talk for hours about history.
I think that's the first reference we've ever had on the conversation to George Washington's farewell address from 1792.
Escalated the academic level of this conversation.
I do think Dwayne Manick did reference Thomas Jefferson's inaugural speech.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
No, I don't know.
Are we just ticking off Founding Fathers now?
Yeah, that's it. That's it. Next week, we'll tune in. We'll be reading the first 65 Federalist Papers. That's what's going to go on next week. No, this is the Kenai Conversation this morning. If you'd like to jump in on the conversation, if you have some thoughts about the borough mayoral election or the future fate of the borough in general, give us a call, 283-8414. Again, 283-8414. We're joined this morning with Liz Earle from the Peninsula Clarion and also Kat Sorensen from the Peninsula Clarion, Jay Barrett, and myself, Shaylin Cochran, this morning with you as well. And thinking about you know, having a new administration coming in eventually at some point, we're going to get this thing settled. Do either of you have thoughts on what either of those candidates will do to change the dynamic of the assembly and how the assembly operates, or perhaps some issues that you think might be brought to the assembly with either of these potential administrations?
I think Liz should just repeat what she said on our car ride over.
It's something, covering the assembly has been a really interesting part of this because it's been so staged, you know, like, and we have the first level of the election, which the assembly has decided, and then we have a last leg, we're going to decide the administration. And then watching the race in the very initial part, you saw a candidate, Norm Blakely, hitch his wagon to Charlie Pierce, where their signs were up together in Sterling, and he mentioned several times that once he knew that Charlie was running, he was planning to run. And that made for kind of an interesting sort of mini caucus on the assembly, because the assembly is also technically nonpartisan. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure that you guys learned through some of the more controversial issues that we've covered. The invocation comes to mind first.
Mm-hmm.
And then other issues like marijuana and alcohol and taxes also, especially through the last budget process. The assembly does have sort of like political leanings and caucuses, to say. And a new administration could take that in a very different direction. Right now, we've got a couple of different assembly members, particularly Kelly Cooper and Willie Dunn from Homer, who lean more progressive. And so under a Pierce administration, I suspect there might be more pushback from that area about taxes, especially given that their districts heavily supported Linda Hutchings.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get more conservative districts like Sterling and possibly parts of the outlying parts of Seward or other areas of District 6, which is an enormous district, that would sort of lean more towards the conservative side. And so I think counterbalancing, we might even see a better balance between the assembly and the administration. We saw a lot of pushback between the Navarre administration and the assembly, especially mm-hmm. during the last budget process. And that led to some disagreements and some imbalances in our budget process. And so perhaps in the future we can learn from that through the two assembly processes, because from my conversations with Charlie Pierce after the election last night, he had said that he's fairly confident that he can work well with the assembly and get to know them. And so that seems like a priority for his administration.
Yeah. You know, speaking on that, you know, one of the things that's going to immediately come up, and Kat, I wanted to get you in on this, is it's already begun, is the school district budget.
Yeah, it's barely into the school year. Well, first quarter ended on Friday, but already talking about next year.
Yeah, isn't that fun? Isn't that fun?
So exciting.
Well, maybe you could bring us up to speed a little bit and by talking a little bit about sort of how things wrapped up last year, sort of where we are and what we're looking forward to as budget process begins now.
Yeah, so I
quiz time.
As we said, journalists are not good at math, so I wrote down a little cheat sheet of numbers. So last year, the biggest issue in the school district, same as this year, is the budget, always.
Always.
And there was a big push from the Board of Education to reach out to the legislator. That's the biggest issue. That's where most of the funding from the school district comes from. There's this year 87.1 from the state overall and 49.73 from the borough. So that's another issue that the mayor is going to have to deal with, whoever it is, Charlie or Linda, figuring out the role of the school district in the overall borough budget. And yeah, so the big issues were just figuring out where to get money from.
it's such an interesting question, and, yeah. and we go over this, it seems like, every year, this and how sort of disjointed that whole process yeah. is, because the district comes up with its budget mm-hmm. based on what it hopes, prays, thinks might happen yeah. at both the state level, and then the borough is trying to figure out what's going to happen at the state level, and then those two things play into what the school district actually ends up really getting. And it just doesn't seem to always make a lot of sense.
It doesn't make a lot of sense, and it's not happening on the same timeline,
right.
which is a big issue for the district. They're trying to hire, they're trying to solidify their budgets in the middle of July, and it seems like a lot of times, not the middle of the July, before July, and it seems like a lot of times the legislator uses educational funding as a pawn in their negotiations, which I have heard Sean Dusick complain about more mm-hmm. times than any person should hear Sean Dusick complain about it. but they are starting by January 15th. They're going to have their preliminary budget for yeah. the upcoming year, which seems insane that is already happening, because I feel like I've been covering it continually. And a big issue that the district is facing currently is their dropping enrollment,
right.
Which puts a huge impact in general on the budget, because if there's less students, they'll receive less money. The foundation funding formula from the state is solely reliant on the number of students enrolled. It's interesting, because 115 students doesn't seem like a lot, but that could be the difference between a handful of teachers in the district. So if those students are gone, those teachers can be gone.
Do you think there's any chance with the change in borough administration that the borough is going to fund the school district to the cap this year?
No. No. I would like to say that there's a chance, but looking at other issues on the borough's plate, there's not enough money to go around. I was at the budget talk at Kenai Central High School on last Tuesday night,
mm-hmm.
and Charlie Pierce was there. So speaking as if the absentee ballots still go in line with that, he was very hopeful about what the educational funding would be in the upcoming years under his administration. But at the same time, it was heavily coupled with the knowledge that the money flowing in the Kenai Peninsula borough isn't as high as we would like it to be. And the first thing, one of the largest cost factors is the educational system. And then inside of that is the healthcare issue.
Yeah.
Which,
another 3 to 4 hours on that
yes,
sometime.
Mm-hmm. Yes. There's a whole nother 3 to 4 hours on that. Definitely.
Might need a whole day for that one.
Yeah. Day and a half too.
Yeah. I'm curious, you know, Superintendent Sean Dusick, mm-hmm. A few weeks back spoke, to the Chambers of Commerce for both Kenai and Soldotna,
mm-hmm.
Kind of the opening salvo of talking about the budget and, mm-hmm. and what the district is essentially grappling with and trying to work with these numbers and educate these kids. And the sense that I got was that, you know, there's a lot of focus on what they've done to not impact the classroom, to not take away resources from the classroom. A lot of work been done in that area. And what that's meant is some things sort of behind the scenes have, you know, there's a bit less administrative staff, support mm-hmm. staff, those sorts of things, kind of behind the scenes stuff. And what I got from his speech at the Chamber of Commerce is that seems to be the angle that he's pushing this round, is that we really, we haven't done anything to really negatively impact the classroom that much, mm-hmm. but the staff cuts behind the scenes are going to start making their presence known in the classroom mm-hmm. That way. So we need to start thinking about, you know, how well we're funding administrative positions and those sorts of things. Do you get that sense too, that that's kind of a focus for Sean Dusick and those people mm-hmm. as they're putting all this together?
Yeah, I'm really getting the sense, like you said, that this is the round of budgeting where they're really worried about it affecting the classrooms. In the past, it's been able to be small things here and there, but at this round, with the ever increasing prices, status quo funding would just not even be enough to keep status quo in the classrooms. I remember at the district-wide budget talk on Tuesday, Principal Carl Kircher over at Mountain View Elementary said that they've been doing a really good job of not impacting any extracurricular activities or events in the school or things like that with their small nest egg from the carnivals and different things like that. But even that's running dry. So those types of things, which they've been using to kind of hide it, it's kind of like hiding the troubles from the kids, you know?
Yeah.
Just pushing, like covering it up, and eventually somebody's going to realize something, and it's going to impact, not realize, but it's going to impact the classroom. And I think that's a major focus this time around, that there's not much that they can do behind the scenes anymore. They can't cut any further without people noticing an impact to the education.
Yeah.
Yeah, in the classroom.
Well, with that, we find ourselves at the bottom of the 10 o'clock hour. This is the Kenai Conversation on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. Joining us this morning, Jay Barrett, of course, myself, and Liz Earle and Kat Sorensen from the Peninsula Clearing. It's a reporter's roundtable. We're going to take a quick break. I forgot to bring in my coffee for the first half of the show, and that is a horrible no-no. So I'm going to go fix that problem right now. If you have some questions, comments, anything, if you'd like to get in on the conversation, 283-8414 is the number. Again, 283-8414. We're going to take a quick break. Stay with us. And welcome back. Thanks for sticking with us on the Kenai Conversation this morning. It's Reporters Roundtable, trying to, I believe, unpack is the term of the day, the recent municipal elections for the Kenai Peninsula Borough. We've been talking about the district school budget with reporters from the Peninsula Clarion, Liz Earle and Kat Sorensen, Jay Barrett and myself, Shaylin Cochran, along with you. If you'd like to jump in on the conversation this morning, 283-8414 is the number. Again, 283-8414. And in sort of sticking with the school budget, which we were talking about before the break, Kat, you were talking about some interesting things, some potential moves that might have to be made in terms of special education within the district, and how all these budget problems play out for that portion of the students.
Yeah. So earlier in the fiscal year 18, is that? Yeah, that one.
Yes.
Fiscal year 18 budget, the district officials were mentioning the fact that a larger amount of special ed students in the district was creating a heavier cost burden. And the state of Alaska makes up for that by funding special education students at 13 times more than another student without those special needs. But then coming into this period when the enrollment is dropping so drastically, if any of the students within that 118 or so numbers that haven't been counted or unenrolled are special education, then that means that the district loses times 13 from that funding formula. So the worst case scenario in this situation is that all 100 of the students unenrolled or no longer accounted for within the district's enrollment are special education students, and that is just taking a huge chunk out of the district budget and something that they just probably did not even account for or couldn't account for.
Yeah, that's something that you know, how do you anticipate costs increasing in that way in terms of not just that you have to spend money on students, but but on particular students and different resources being needed for different students. That's a whole other sort of part of the puzzle that probably doesn't get talked about nearly enough.
Yeah, and it's a delicate issue because you are quantifying the education of a certain student, and you don't want to go about doing that and kind of estimating the costs of each particular student and what their needs are. But it's something that needs to be thought of, especially as enrollment is dropping drastically, it seems, this coming year. And of course, there's going to be a handful of special needs students in that pile of over 100.
Yeah.
And that's going to impact the classroom and in ways outside of just that special needs student's own education. Because yes, the money that they received from having that student in the classroom has been budgeted in other ways.
Yeah, and also probably worth asking, you know, why are we seeing an increase in students that have special needs? Where is that coming from? Is it more kids fitting certain definitions and more definitions of what special needs are being sort of brought into a school district? That's a
very large question.
I'm good at big questions, yes, that big questions Nobody can answer.
Well, when I have ever posed this question to myself when I'm writing about the stories, for some reason the first thing that comes to mind is students coming from homeschooling situations and being put into the district. That's what I see is my initial gut reaction, where parents are at home in, say, Nanilchik or someplace not directly close to, well, Nanilchik has a great school system.
Someplace kind of in the middle.
Yeah, someplace kind of in the middle. And they're just struggling with educating their child at home because of certain special needs, so they decide to bring them to the schools, the school district. So that's my initial gut reaction. I could also get really conspiracy theory, too, if you want, and say that it's modern times.
Is it in the water?
It's in the water.
Yeah.
The snowflake generation. That's stepping on.
You know, it's not altogether unworthy to point that out. And something that I wanted to talk about that you brought up earlier, that kind of dovetails off of that, is social media reactions. And you know, frankly, when we post our stories online, we get some pretty decent sort of audience engagement, some interaction, good questions. We don't have a whole lot of flame throwing and name calling on our social media. I know the Clarion in the past, on different topics and with different stories, has had comment sections a mile long with all sorts of interesting viewpoints on it. But I guess maybe with this, talking about the elections in particular, and, and then more broadly, social media and journalism in general, what did you see happen with this election?
Any mayoral story would get a lot of traction, especially especially the cease and desist letter, things along those lines. And just election stories in general, I think, going back to the statement we made about it being a more personal election instead of bipartisan, that kind of brought out the most aggressive in people online. If I feel like it's a social media, it's a social media forte to be able to post your opinion online. And if you have strong opinions about your friend or neighbor becoming mayor, why not just type them away? And totally welcomed, and I admire people who go about doing that. And I love the interactions that happen on our Facebook posts. But sometimes it does get a little nasty and kind of goes back to the gossip part, where it's hearsay. Well, my neighbor said this about this person, so I'm not going to vote for them. Or that's why this article is wrong.
Yeah.
You know, I was actually at the Clarion when we first put stories online there. And it turned me off completely from ever wanting listener comments on stories. And so when I went to Kodiak, to KMXT, and spiffed up the website there, it was like, I do not want free flowing, you know, back and forth comments on there. All comments have to be moderated. And, you know, we just had a fight about it. And, you know, that's how it is down there. All comments are moderated. They have to have, like, we don't require them to sign up or anything.
Yeah.
But we, you know, they had to be civil and they had to be fact-based. The thing that upset me, still upsets me the most about comments, are people who don't actually know what they're talking about.
Or don't click open the article.
Yes.
People who tend
only
to
read the headline.
Or the
and
little summary.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's actually a comment on Shaylin's story, which I contributed to this morning on the election, a comment on the Facebook post of it. It's like, oh, how many outstanding absentee ballots are there? Mm-hmm. Well, if you opened the story, you'd find out because it's in there.
Well, there's a certain value to having that openness, though. I have a lot of personal feelings about social media and journalism, just in regards to the relationship between privacy and public life. Because, like most journalists, I find it a deliciously useful tool, because you can see into this aspect of people's lives that you would never be able to see otherwise. You see their photographs, you see this, like, especially when you report on someone who, say, has died, you get a chance to see parts of their life, like that poor man who drowned on the Kenai River this year. A lot of the rescue efforts happened coordinated via social media. I got to see photos of his family, his life, and that never would have happened otherwise. And for me to locate his daughter and to track down those photographs and find the full aspect of that story wouldn't have been possible without social media. And yet there's also a sort of part of me that thinks that there should be a line between what I can see as a person who's my job is to make things public. And there should be a line between what I morally can use off of someone's personal life on their Twitter feed, on their Instagram. So when I get sort of like a gray moral area, when I can tell that something's personal, I sort of leave it alone.
But shouldn't that line be drawn by the social media user themselves and not us?
Well, see, and that's something that I noticed, and getting back to the mayoral election, if you followed these the two candidates on social media, I felt like Charlie Pierce had a much more, at least in the beginning, a much more robust kind of social media campaign. Yeah. He was Facebook living everything, pictures all the time, doing interviews sort of with himself and taking questions and all this. Linda, towards the end, was much more active as well, but a lot of things that were talked about in very passionate ways, and some of the more personal issues, those came out, and sometimes they came out first on social media. It was the candidate themselves bringing those out, addressing sort of scuttlebutt around the community, using social media to get out in front of those things and opening the doors of those conversations themselves.
Mm-hmm. And that's a really useful platform, because in part it's a lot easier for someone to just click the share button.
Yeah.
Right.
Because for instance, I think of like when that domestic violence story came out, that was first addressed on Charlie Pierce's Facebook page. He put that out in a long monologue, and a lot of people shared that. Mm-hmm. And that was a really valuable craft, I'm sure, for him to address that. But the other part of that is that there is, you were right, Jay, that there's no verification. People can just put whatever they want on mm-hmm. there. And the danger of that, as we've observed in November in 2016, is the fake news phenomenon. Mm-hmm. People...
Just 2016?
In always, forever. Because I think that maybe journalists just put on the blinders and didn't realize that half of what was out there wasn't true.
But, you know, in regards to, Kat, your comment, you know, shouldn't the line be drawn by the Twitter and mm-hmm. Facebook users, you know, I would think that, you know, they're not sophisticated enough to know that their stuff is public, if it can be seen by the public.
Okay. Yeah, that's...
You know, as a photographer, you know, when I was a photojournalist, mm-hmm. I go to, you know, things and take pictures, and somebody say, you shouldn't be taking a picture of that. I go, mm-hmm. well, you know, it's a thing happening in public, you know, it's...
Right.
And, well, you shouldn't put their names in there. Well, you know, blah, blah, blah. And so... I don't know. Does the Poynter Institute have an opinion on that's, what we can use from the from websites and Twitters and?
I don't recall. In college, I don't recall a lot of conversations about this, because that's stuff that you kind of, I feel like you, over the course of your reporting career, you tend to tackle on an individual basis, and mm-hmm. and some people sort of get it, for lack of a better term, and other people are very, very guarded about their privacy and mm-hmm. what they want shared and what you as a reporter should or should not have access to, and I have total respect for that, but at the same time, you know, there's a responsibility, and when things are happening in the public sphere... It's not necessarily my job as a reporter to explain to you what is and what is mm-hmm. not the public sphere. You know, it's interesting. It brings, talking about social media reactions and all this stuff, you know, I dug out just a question that our general manager, Jenny Nyman, had that I wanted to get your opinion on as well, in terms of using social media and all these tools that are available to everyone now. I dug out a scene from Back to the Future. And I've got the clip pulled up here, and it has to do with this idea that everyone, not everyone, but so many people now possess a lot of the same basic tools and access to platforms that journalists have to do things. I'm going to play this clip real quick. 60 has been a TV star president because just out of necessity for what the electric craves and demands in a leader, but getting back to that initial question of, you know, sort of the role of all these new tools, everybody's got an iPhone, everybody mm-hmm. can Facebook Live, you can Periscope, you can stand in front of a courthouse and watch people, and you don't have to be a quote-unquote credentialed journalist, you don't have to have an editor, you can have your own platform. Good or bad?
I came into high school just as Twitter was really getting off its ground. I went into high school in 2007, and I went to college just as Twitter was beginning to explode in terms of a professional usage, mm-hmm. especially for journalists. I don't think that line is a clear one, because, yeah, everybody has these tools available, photographs, video, Periscope, Snapchat Live, as we saw with the horrors of watching people stream things that should not be streamed live on Facebook.
Yeah.
Those tools are available, and it's up to people to learn how to use them. But on the flip side of this, I think that one of the reasons I'm confident that my job will never be automated is that one of the values of having a journalist is the accrued wisdom that comes with that, and the sort of painful corrections that you get, and the wisdom that you get from talking to somebody who asks you not to publicize something, but you have to anyway because that's your job. Mm-hmm. And in social media world, I think that, in part responding to what you said, Kat, that I think that it's our responsibility to be the ones to carry the weight of what to decide, because that's our job, and because we have that sort of unquantifiable accrued wisdom over time of what should be public and what shouldn't. I don't think people should have to live their lives guarding themselves from us.
I wonder how much, just speaking in broad terms, how much of the general public respects that accrued knowledge and that sort of institutional knowledge, and to get kind of academic about it, the sort of one of the things that's blurred is this the classic sort of gatekeeper role. Mm-hmm. And Jay, I'm interested from your perspective, because as you mentioned earlier, I believe Methuselah signed your high school yearbook. how have you seen the sort of gatekeeper role change in terms of And be this at the local level or at a broader level, determining sort of what's news and what should be important for people to think about, because now there is so much to think about. I feel like we've reached sort of this critical mass in terms of what, as a general population, we're able to take in information-wise, process, and then make decisions about it. And what are your thoughts?
You know, I once had a conversation. I was covering a story. It was a zoning story down by the college here. And I called up a neighbor who had filed a complaint with the city of Soldotna about a neighbor and her horses. And
Farm animals, they spark feelings.
Yeah. And the woman who had the horses claimed that the right-of-way that she had to, maintain should be counted in her acreage. And if it was, she could have horses. But his argument was, no, only the property that's platted should be counted, and it was small enough that it wasn't big enough to have horses in that zoning area, because it was in the city. And so I called him up, and he was really upset that I wanted to do a story about it. And he said, why do you get to decide what's news? And, you know, I kind of didn't have an answer at the time. It was like, well, it's kind of interesting. And we had a little conversation about it. I think it's easier now to get the pulse of what's interesting community-wide because of social media.
I think that's very true, yeah.
Yeah, which, you know, isn't always, you know, you want to make sure you don't turn it into Entertainment Tonight every day.
Well, I just did this very similar incidents with that story that I wrote about the neighbors on Betty Lou Drive out in Sterling. Seemed like a very mundane story that wouldn't really attract much interest at the assembly, but actually I got several phone calls about it, and it sparked people's interest after the fact. So perhaps people who didn't know and who were involved in the story when I chose to write about it might be upset that I'm choosing to write about their one petition in their one neighborhood, but it's really very interesting to people who might not know about it. And so in a certain way, I go back to what my college mentor told me once, that be interested in what you're interested in because you're interested in it.
Yeah, I've tended to go with the idea that I don't have a particularly unique view on the world or some capacity for questioning my space around me. So if I notice something and I'm curious about it, there's a really good chance that at least one other person is curious about that same thing. And if you're informing somebody about something, well, I guess on some level you're getting your job done.
Well, on a different note, we receive you guys do too, like the dispatches from the police, right? Mm-hmm. So we got the dispatch on a Saturday morning about a fire alarm going off at the Sterling Elementary School. And I saw that and I didn't really think much of it. You know, fire alarms go off all the time. But then the next day I was in the Sterling Elementary group, Sterling Crime Watch group on my Facebook, because I live out by Sterling, and people were just going bananas over this, and I really understood why it was such a big issue and what actually happened. And from that, and I kind of got this social media aspect of why I didn't find it interesting, but why it mattered. So it kind of flipped that on its head for me, and I didn't 100% recognize it at first, but the community outreach and anger over the man going into the school through this Facebook group kind of solidified, like, oh, this is a big deal. This is an issue.
And that's a very interesting sort of distinction. What's interesting and what matters.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's a bit of, you know, it's fun to do the fun stories always, but then there's all, you know, we've got to have our broccoli too.
Yeah.
There's a little bit of that.
And spinach.
And spinach.
You know, we have like literally 3 minutes left. I want to ask back to the elections, if I could. Should.
Yeah.
What do you guys think about the elections that didn't have any, that weren't contested around here?
On my level at the Board of Education, I think that there was the contested one between Joe Arness and Jason Tarainen. And I think, yeah, I got a thumbs up for pronouncing his last name right. Yeah. I think that is a shift. Joe Arness had been on the school board for 21 years. Mm-hmm. It's a shift, and I'm excited to see how it plays out with a new person representing Nikiski, but then also two new people uncontested representing Nanilchik and, oh no, just one. sorry, I'm blanking. Debbie Carey was uncontested, so I'm really excited for her to be on the board because she's been vocal and is taking over for Bill Holt, so that should be interesting. And then
at the borough level, the vast majority of places were uncontested. Yeah.
Service area boards have always been an issue trying to get those filled, even in the appointed positions, never mind the elected
ones. There was only one that was contested as a senior.
Accident.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, they didn't even know that they were running against each other. I called them about it, and I was curious. But it sparked a memory for me, because I remembered about a year ago or a year and a half ago, the Assembly dissolved the Central Peninsula Hospital Service Area Board, and there was a lot of outcry at the Assembly about this, talking about how the administration was taking away the public voice, the elected board representing them at the hospital level. But the service area board talked about how we get together and we spend public dollars doing it and we don't do anything. So they felt that they were fine to be dissolved because they had enough oversight. At this level, with the uncontested races, it seems like almost a little bit of a waste of paper to have these races often on the boards, because most of them, they don't really apply to you. You don't know what's on them. The mayor ends up appointing half of these positions anyway. And so it raised more questions for me over whether these service area boards are meritorious of being on the ballot, because it seems like people don't have a lot to say about them. In regards to the two uncontested assembly races, that's relatively uncommon, I guess.
Yeah.
That Ken Carpenter will be on for another year in Seward. And Seward's always a challenging district because you have to drive so far. It's a huge time commitment. But people always do it. And we did lose Brandy Holmdahl early into her term through no fault of her own. She had a job situation. But then Kelly Cooper's situation actually surprised me, because Homer is usually a fairly intense political hotbed. But it seems like she has gained a lot of public support. I think there were like 10 write-in votes, which shows that a lot of people who did take the time to vote for her supported her.
The one that really surprised me was Soldotna with annexation and pot.
It's a return and...
We could spend 45 minutes talking about Soldotna.
But with all of the big issues coming up and seeing the intense feelings that annexation brings, I thought that maybe somebody would want to step up and try and bring that into the public forum for however they want to, whichever side they're on. But I think that my gut feeling is that the next election in Soldotna will be highly contested after decisions are made. And that, I think, is a big issue.
I like that analysis a lot, and it'll be a lot of fun to pay attention to. Hey, I want to thank Kat Sorensen and Elizabeth Earle from the Peninsula Clarion for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much for having us.
Jay Barrett running the board. I'm Shaylin Cochran. I want to thank you for tuning into the Kenai Conversation this morning. Missed any portion of the show? Of course, we'll have it up on our website a little bit later today, kdll.org. Have a great morning.